بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله الحمد لله وكفى وسلام على عباده الذين اصطفى، أما بعد، فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. سبحان الذي أسرى بعبده ليلا من المسجد الحرام إلى المسجد الأقصى الذي باركنا حوله لنريه من آياتنا إنه هو السميع البصير. صدق الله العظيم. Assalamu alaikum, my dear respected elders and brothers in Islam. Alhamdulillah, with Allah's fazl and karam and rahmah, we have come to almost, I think, part five now of our series. And at our last gathering, we discussed how Zionism embroiled itself or married with the Western culture, in particularly Britain, in solving the Jewish problem. In so much as how the Europeans wanted to get rid of the Jewish population from their midst, and they suggest the option of Uganda. But after the collapse of the Osmani Caliphate, the Zionists then pressed for the Palestinian issue, and how it was then become convenient for Britain to implant a Zionist state in the midst of the Muslim world. We left it at around 1931, after the first conflict between the Muslims and the Zionists. Up until then, throughout all the history we have touched, at no point did Muslims have a conflict, in particular with regard to Jerusalem. We see the issue now change after the 1929 conflict, or the Al-Buraq Wall conflict, which we discussed. Up until then, there was no such issue of Palestine, neither was there an issue between Muslims and Jews. It is only after this that things start changing. Now, during the early 1920s, in fact, right from the beginning of the year 1900, the Zionists tried to recruit as many Jewish people as possible to go to Palestine. And they came up with a lot of slogans. And one of the main slogans they had is a land without a people for a people without a land. They're basically saying Palestine is an area without any people, and we, the Jews, are a people without a land. So a land without a people for a people without a land. And they used this slogan to indoctrinate their own people first and foremost, because the Jews of Europe were against Zionism. As we discussed, it was against their halacha, their teachings, for Jews to move into Palestine. And Zionism was a secular entity which did not go along with, if you like, the Orthodox Jews. And the Jews did not accept Zionism as their solution to the problem that they were facing in Europe. Inshallah, we will see today how there is also now a convenience of marriage between Zionists and Jews, as there was a convenience of marriage between the Zionists and the British in the early 1920s. Before I touch that issue, I would like to go back to one very important issue for us. What happened to the Khilafah system? After the collapse of the Uthmani Khilafah, what did the Ummah do to revive it? This is a crucial point for us to understand. And if we remember, if we go back in the early 1890s and 1880s, nation statehood was indoctrinated in the Arab world. And Muslim leaders that emerged were basically the puppets of British colonialism. Immediately after the collapse of the Uthmani Caliphate, in the early 20s, each leader in different segments of the Arab world tried to revive the Khilafah system and become a Khalifa so that he would have the greatest domain or area of control. So it was a political motive. The first of this was in 1926 by King Fuad of Egypt. The Al-Azhari, certain scholars within the Al-Azhari supported him for this. However, when he called a meeting, only 26 people from throughout the world attended his conference to revive the Khilafah. And a lot of people understood why. They didn't attend because they knew King Fuad's intention. This was to consolidate his position within the Muslim world. And it was a political move entirely to consolidate his position. Therefore, the movement in 26 collapsed. The Khilafah movement, as far as Egypt was concerned, became wiped out. Later that year, during the Hajj of 1926, Ibn Saud, who, as we, if you recall, he was a Wahhabi, and the Wahhabi movement had just begun, and he'd taken over the Hijaz, the whole of Hijaz, call up another meeting. Now, a lot of people attended this meeting. The reason they attended this meeting is because Makkah and Medina was central to the whole Ummah. People go there for Hajj, and the Wahhabis were at the beginning totally against the Sufis, in particular the Sufis of the northern African states. The Sufism was very strong in Somalia and Sudan, second only to Indian subcontinent, but it is much stronger in northern Africa. So these people were concerned as to how their rights of Hajj would be interfered if this area to the Mecca and Medina is being controlled by Wahhabis, whether their performing of Hajj rites, which are slightly different in every mazhab, will they be interfered with. So a big gathering got around at Hajj of 1926. But what also transpired was Ibn Saud's idea of reviving the Khilafah and bringing it to Mecca Medina. However, the greater Ummah, the people who gathered around that conference, rejected the idea. So as far as the Khilafah system was concerned, it basically now it's almost coming to die in a, not from the nationalistic point of view. Something very great happened. The Muslim ulamas, in particular, the Muslim ulamas of Indian subcontinent, wanted to revive the Khilafah system. And their attack against the British colonialism was known as the Khilafah movement. When Indian Muslims stood up against the British, their movement is actually called the Khilafah movement. The leading ulama was a person called Maulana Muhammad Ali. When Maulana Muhammad Ali, in 1931, came to Britain for a roundtable conference as to the destination of India, with him was his brother called Maulana Shaukat Ali. Unfortunately, Maulana Muhammad Ali passed away in London at this conference. When this happened, Shaukat Haj Amin, who was the head of the people in Palestine, invited Shaukat Ali to bury his brother, Maulana Muhammad Ali, in Jerusalem. Now, this was something very great that's going to take place now, because for the first time, we have a revival of the Ummah, Muslims taking care of other Muslims only on the basis of Islamic faith. Okay? Although there was no ideology of creating a Khilafah, but there is now an ideology of creating an Ummah state. Wherever the Muslims are, they are one Ummah. Shaukat Ali accepted the offer of Haj Amin, and Maulana Muhammad Ali was taken to Jerusalem to be buried there. When Maulana Muhammad Ali's at his funeral, there was a very big gathering. A lot of ulamas from the Hijaz area, from Egypt, neighboring countries, all of them came to his funeral because he was regarded as a great alim, one who tried to fight the colonialists so they could relate with him, somebody who wanted to revive the Khilafah system as well. A lot of people came to this gathering. The reason I'm relating this is something very great happened at this funeral. Somebody suggested that we should have a meeting to decide. This was 1931. Remember, the first incident that had taken place, the Al Burakol incident, was in 1929, just a year earlier. The Muslims, for the first time, the elite, especially those who are learned, were now aware of the plans of Zionism. So somebody suggested at this funeral that we should have a meeting and decide what we should do for the case of Palestine. And this is for the first time ever in the Muslim Ummah, the issue of Palestine as a single entity arises. Okay? Very important diverging point here. Up until now, the Muslims did not consider the Palestinian issue as a separate entity. At this funeral, things changed. They decided to have a meeting in December 1931. And this meeting was called the Congress of Jerusalem. Those who study history, Islamic history, very important Congress this to study. And especially those who study the Khilafah system. Now, what happened when they announced this conference? Immediately the Zionists started spreading rumors to say that the idea of Maulana Shaukat Ali and Haj Amin is to revive the Khilafah and bring the Khalifa in Jerusalem. And if that happens, all you nation states, Syria, we had Iraq, Jordan, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, you will be in threat. So the leaders of these countries started going against this conference. However, the Muslim elites from Chechnya, Bosnia, as far as Singapore, Malaysia, in fact, 145 delegates attended the Jerusalem Congress in 1931. And it was an amazing gathering. If you consider 1931, people were traveling by ship. There was no aeroplanes. People as far away. However, the rumor was so great that Maulana Shaukat Ali and Haj Amin had to say that this conference is not for reviving the Khilafah, because all the leaders were against it. Okay, and the Zionists were spreading this rumor. Now, to understand the ideology or the philosophy of what was happening here, it's very simple for us today. Similar thing has happened to us today as well, where the Western world has designated Muslims who consider or look into jihad as a fundamentalist. Okay, so immediately what you say is, I am not a jihadi. Okay, because the psychology said that to be a good Muslim is not to be a jihadi Muslim. Similarly, a scenario in a case was a psychological atmosphere was created in 1930 that a Muslim who said he was for the Khilafah was a bad Muslim. So all the Muslims were saying, we don't want the Khilafah. This conference is not for the Khilafah. Does that make sense? Okay. So therefore, this meeting took place in 1931, okay, against the backdrop of the Khilafah movement, but it was for Palestinian issue. What did happen, there's two things. One, the Khilafah movement died, okay, because of this conference. However, the Palestinian issue was revived within the Ummah. And these delegates who had come from throughout the world now became the ambassadors of the Palestinian issue. And they moved from, as I said, as far away as Caucasus in Chechnya, to Africa, to Far East, Middle East, throughout the world. So now the Palestinian issue becomes a single entity on its own right. And this started in December 1931. I would like to go back now to what was happening to Europe. After the Al-Burak Wall incident, in the 1930s, in the late 80s, we had the pogroms in Russia, okay, where the Jews were persecuted and they had to move into the Ottoman Caliphate, and some of them now moved back to Western Europe. In the early 30s, anti-Semitism started to rise in Europe, in particularly Germany. Now, two things were happening. One was there's anti-Semitism, which everybody knows about, and that is common knowledge. There's anti-Semitism in Europe. But the second thing, which the history books hide and you have to really search for, but the evidence is substantial and it is there in concrete, and that is the United States of America drastically reduced the intake of Jews from Europe. They basically closed their borders. They would not take in Jews. It was amazing that they were making sanctimonious demands on the Palestinians and the Muslims to absorb the Jews, while they themselves had closed the doors off to Jews. And these two things were happening simultaneously. I will give you the evidence as we go along. Just to remind ourselves of the date, in 1933, 30th of January, Hitler became the Chancellor of Germany on the ticket of anti-Semitism. Oppression of the Jews had already started. 1935, Jews were barred from major occupations in Germany. They had to prove themselves 100 years back to be a pure Aryan blood before they could even marry a German. There was great persecutions of the Jewish race within the German nations. In 1939, 20,000 Jews were killed in Germany. The beginning of the concentration camp. Now, Hitler was one of the most barbaric person in Western civilization. Not only did he not do a lot of harm to the Jews, where over 6 million Jews were killed in concentration camps. This is no small matter. In total, it is estimated he killed 10 million people in concentration camps, 6 million of whom were Jews, and over 4 million made up of Slavs and Gypsies. They were the other two races that he exterminated. But Hitler did do no favor to the Palestinians and Muslims either. Because if it wasn't for Hitler, there would not be a union between the Jews and the Zionists. Up until 1939, even the British Jewish Board would not accept Zionism as their ideology. 1939, think about it. The British Jews refused to accept Zionism as their solution. It is only after Hitler's persecution upon the Jews that now a marriage of convenience, because they had nowhere to go, a marriage of convenience takes place between the Jews and the Zionists. The European Jews now see Zionism as a way to escape with their lives, literally. Because if they did not accept this ideology, they were going to be exterminated. They are likely, and most likely, were going to be exterminated in Europe. What is important for us to learn here is what did the West do while Hitler, this barbarian, was killing the Jews? What did the West do? And it is amazing. In the 30s, America called on the conference to decide on the immigration of Jews, what we should do with the Jews. And in this meeting, I think they called in about 30 countries at this meeting, and America proposed that it would accept, their quota was for 153,000 only. Yet, even they could not meet this quota. And in effect, they only accepted 23,000 Jews, only 23,000 throughout the war years. France was saturated, and later on it got occupied by Germany. The Benelux countries were saturated again for the same reason. Our British England, very sympathetic England, wriggled out with sympathy. They refused to take any more. They just simply did not take any Jewish refugees while Hitler was taking them to the concentration camp. In effect, the question to ask, or that arises, is what signal was the West sending to Hitler? Amazing. These were the powers to be, America, Europe, Britain in particular. What were they telling Hitler when they were saying, we will not take in Jews? In fact, this is a very dire signal sending to Hitler that you can do what you like. So much so for the Europeans. Let's look what the Zionists did. And it is amazing what the Zionists did. When America called this conference, the Zionist ideology was to belittle this conference. Why? Although this conference was called, and one of the issues was how to help the Jews of Europe, the Zionists did not want anybody to raise funds or to absorb Jews, because this would be in contradiction with their ideology of moving Jews from Europe into Palestine, just in case Jews go somewhere else. And I would like you to quote you some of the people within the Zionist movement, what they're saying. Ben Gurion's statement, right, regarding this conference. He says, no rationalization can turn the conference from a harmful to a useful one. What we should do and should be done is to limit the damage as far as possible. In this conference, the president of Dominican Republic said, I will absorb 100,000 Jews from Europe. He offered the Zionist sabotage his effect. His offer was death, sabotaged by the Zionists, and they said, we will not accept this. The reason being, again, I quote you Ben Gurion. He says Zionism is in danger because of this conference. And they must do, the Zionists must do whatever they can to stop the world population gathering funds and being sympathetic to the European Jews. It is incredible that the Zionists, in one hand, did not want to help their own people being oppressed by the Germans. Ben Gurion again in 1942, this is the time when already the Holocaust had begun and was in full swing. The catastrophe of the European Jewry is not in direct manner my business. The mind boggles as to the ideology of the Zionist. He's also recorded to say, if I knew it was possible to save all the Jewish children of Germany, all the children of Germany, by their transfer to England, and only half of them, that means he's basically saying if half of them die, by transferring them to Palestine, I would choose the latter. These are Ben Gurion's words on record. Okay? You look at any history books, you can quote this wherever you like. It's amazing what the Zionists were trying to preach at the time when their own people were being massacred by Hitler. While this was going on, obviously, and the persecution of Jews in Germany increased, the intake or the immigration in Palestine increased as well. So much so that, I'll quote you a few numbers, we looked at last time, by 1931 they had about 174,000 Jewish people in the whole of Palestine. These numbers now start to increase, and it's a direct result of the persecution of Jews in Europe, and in particular Germany. In 1932, they had 10,000 more come in. In 1933, 30,000. In 1934, that went up to 42,000. In 1935, that went up to 62,000. There's this amazing influx of Jews into Palestine. Some of these were pro-Zionist, some of these were just basically getting away from the tortures of the European, and particularly Hitler. Now, when these Jews were coming into Palestine, they brought with them amazing ideologies. First and foremost, they did not mingle with the society in Palestine. They tried to create their own enclaves. Whatever land they got, and this land, we'll talk about the land in a minute because it's a very important point. They tried to create their own culture, society, and their own infrastructure. They became independent. They did not want to be dependent on the local population. So much so that no Palestinian was employed on their land. They would not buy any goods from a Palestinian. They would not sell any goods to a Palestinian. So immediately, they started employing apartheid system as soon as they arrived. Obviously, the Palestinians became very concerned and agitated about this. The political elite of Palestine was still looking either towards, as we talked earlier, towards pan-Islamism, or then the second way is they went back to Europe, and in particular to Britain. They came to Britain to request that they be given a Palestinian state. However, Britain again refused, and things started getting worse in Palestine. In 1935, it also emerged, and I'll just quote you one incident, that the Jews, and the Zionists in particular, were not only there to come and stay, but they were there for a motive. And an incident in 1935 highlights this. A Zionist had ordered a barrel of shipment of cement. It was a very large containment. When it came to the port, accidentally one of the barrels got open, and they found that it had guns. When they opened the whole containment, they found that it had approximately 800 guns and 400,000 rounds of ammunition. This single incident, which was then basically spread into the Palestinian community, and they got to know the real motives of the Zionists. This got one person, Sheikh Izzaluddin al-Qasim, to rise up against this menace. And he was the first Palestinian, he was, I think, a Syrian by origin, but he was the first person in Palestine to start a jihad movement against the Zionists. That's why Sheikh Izzaluddin al-Qasim Brigade is the military wing of Hamas today, and they've named him after this person. However, his group only managed to, if we say, kill one person. Only one Jewish person who was in the military was killed by him and his people. Immediately thereafter, the British surrounded him and his group, and everybody was killed. And Sheikh al-Qasim's grave is still present in Palestine today. However, what this incident highlighted was the Zionist ideology, that they were not there as peaceful immigrants or refugees. They were there for a motive, and their motive was to occupy Palestine. This created, in 1936, a big revolt. Unfortunately, the ideology that was put behind it was by strike. The Palestinians started a revolt, which started in 1936 and it ended in 1939. This was a three-year revolt. However, the means of the revolt, with hindsight now, we understand that it was a mistake because they started to strike. And I just mentioned earlier that the Zionist entity was independent of the Palestinians. So when the Palestinians started to strike, they were basically affecting themselves and the British. The British were still, remember, they're still ruling Palestine. And the Palestinian disgust, or their revolt, was against the British. While the Palestinians were revolting against the British, this allowed the Zionists again to solidify and to create their independent communes. Because the Palestinians were engaged revolting against the British, and the British were suppressing the Palestinians, that left the Zionists totally independent to do basically whatever they like. In 1936, when Britain realized that the Palestinians were really upset, and they meant, and it wasn't just a sporadic movement, they commissioned somebody called Lord Peel, and Lord Peel Commission was started, and he proposed two things. The two things he proposed was, one was to petition Palestine, and the second option, he said, is make transfer of people. That means basically wherever there is a majority of Jewish people and a minority of Palestinians, the Palestinians should move out from that area and go wherever there is a majority. So basically create enclaves within Palestine of majority rule. And from this, the reaction of the two different people will give us an indication of the problem we have now. Wiseman, who is one of the leaders of the Zionist movement, was ecstatic. And he basically said, and this is his statement, the Jews would be fools not to accept this. Even if the land that the Peel Commission allocates were the size of a tablecloth. The reason he says this is because no Zionist can forego the smallest portion of land of Israel. And this land will become a springboard for us to occupy the whole of Palestine. Now, it's their words. This is the ideology they had, that even if they give us the smallest piece of land, we should accept it. Once we solidify it here, we will use this as a springboard to occupy the whole of Palestine. And this was the same fears the Palestinians had, that if we give the Zionists anything, this will just simply be a springboard to occupy us. Therefore, the Palestinians refused to accept this. This was in November 1936. Therefore, the revolt started again, this time in much greater intensity and greater violence. There were riots, a lot of British police died. There were riots against each other amongst the Palestinian community itself, a little bit affecting the Jews, but mainly it was between the Palestinians and the British. What these riots did, which lasted 3 years, was it left the Palestinian community totally handicapped. It had 4,500 of its people killed. 6,000 Palestinians were imprisoned by the British. But the greatest catastrophe that was faced by the Palestinians was the exile of their leaders. The Palestinian leaders, almost each and every one of them, either was imprisoned, either had died, or had gone into exile. Therefore, the Palestinian community, as earlier on when the Uthmani Caliphate collapsed, had no leader to speak of within the country. And in these 3 years, the Zionists had made hay, that consolidated themselves, had become very strong, and had become an independent little enclave within the Palestinian state. In 39, if we recall our history, world history as well, in September 39, Britain declared war with Germany. Britain now had to dangle its carrots to the Palestinians. And we Muslims, unfortunately, have been fools throughout our history. Whenever they need us, they dangle a few things and we get pacified. We accept and believe their word and they do not keep their honor. And this is what happened again in 1939. In May 1939, just before the declaration, Britain declares war with Germany. The British establish a commission to see how they can solve the Palestinian problem. And they set up four principles, and it's amazing what they say. They said, we will limit Jewish immigration to only 75,000 people for the next 5 years. So in the next, between 1939 and 1944, we will only allow 75,000 Jews to come in. Okay. The second thing it said, after the 5 years, the Palestinian people will determine, and it is their right to say how many Jews should come in, from Europe or from wherever. Third point was Jews would be restricted to buy land in Palestine. The fourth point, and this was the most important for the Palestinians, is within 10 years, by 1949, this was in 1939, by 1949, Palestine will become an independent Palestinian state. Okay, of course, this is reasonably accepted for the Palestinians. However, the Zionists considered this document is illegal. They started sabotaging all the British main ports in Palestine. They bombed their centers. They started robbing banks. They bombed train stations, railway lines. And the beginning of the Zionist terrorist acts begin now. However, it was only a few months. This was in May. In September, as I said, war was declared. As soon as war was declared, both the Palestinians and the Zionists allied with the British. Okay. Although the Palestinians, for them, it was very difficult to do this because it was Britain that was an obstacle towards creating peace, and they could have allied themselves as a whole en masse, with the Germans, but they didn't do that. They allied with the British. However, the Zionists, again, were much more clever. They had looked in advance. They were looking towards creating a state, and the Palestinians were much more passive. The Palestinians who had enrolled with the British were basically employed in Palestine itself to keep peace and order. Whereas the Zionists, who had enrolled with the British, who actually saw action, they had their own brigade. Now, an own brigade was a whole battalion of Zionists, and they saw action in Italy. They were highly trained by the British. They used the warriors to become one of the most sophisticated army in the Middle East. According to MI6, it is estimated 30,000 Zionist members of the Haganah became professionally trained and armed by the British. This own brigade had their own Zionist flag, which is the blue line with the Star of David. They had own flag as well. And just as a point of interest, these two lines on the flag of Israel, what they indicate is two rivers, River Nile and River Euphrates. In between is the Star of David to say that basically Israel will rule this area. And this is their ambition or goal. And this is if you look at the greater Eretz Israel map, one of the biggest of their maps, they have got several, but one of the biggest of their maps shows that between Nile and River Euphrates become professionally trained and armed by the British. This own brigade had their own Zionist flag, which is the blue line with the Star of David. They had own flag as well. And just as a point of interest, these two lines on the flag of Israel, what they indicate is two rivers, River Nile and River Euphrates. In between is the Star of David to say that basically Israel will rule this area. And this is their ambition or goal. And this is if you look at the greater Eretz Israel map, one of the biggest of their maps, they have got several, but one of the biggest of their maps shows that between Nile and River Euphrates, all of that area is what they consider as Israel. And this is a colonialist ideology. As I was saying, that MI6 had acknowledged that 30,000, this was in 1942, that 30,000 of their members, Zionist members, had become fully trained by them and were a sophisticated army. David Ben-Gurion, again, I would like to quote him. He said that the First World War had given us Balfour Declaration. We looked at that, how Balfour Declaration had come about. This time, he said, this is the Second World War, we must bring about a Jewish state. So he had already looked forward. Okay, and this was him quoting in 1939, his role of assisting the British. Talking about Balfour, I would just like to go back one point. When Balfour Declaration was originally given in 1917, after the Al Burak Wall incident in 1929, the British went back to him to say, what did you mean by a Jewish homeland? Because the crisis in Palestine are getting out of hand and we would like to understand this. And he wrote another letter, the same letter, the 117 words we talked about. He wrote another letter that by a Jewish homeland, I did not mean a Jewish state. It's very important for us to remember this letter as well, because if we accept Balfour Declaration, if they're going to quote, if the Zionist entities are going to quote us Balfour Declaration to justify the state of Israel, then a letter in 1931 by Balfour himself, who by now had become a statesman, he was no longer in the government, but he was a statesman now. He said that what I meant by a Jewish homeland was the ability of a Jewish people to live in the state of Palestine. It was not to create a state of Israel in Palestine. Two different things. And this is a letter dated by Balfour in 1931. Those who wish to see this letter, we've got a copy of this letter, and it's very, very important. The British also were aiding the Zionists. And I'll quote you Churchill's diaries. And this was recorded by Churchill in print in 1941. He stated, I may say at once that if Britain and the United States emerge victorious from the war, remember the war finished in 45, this is 1941, the creation of a greater Jewish state in Palestine, inhabited by millions of Jews, will be one of the leading features of the peace conference. So Churchill in 1941 had already decided that once the war finishes, he is going to help the Zionists establish a Zionist state in Palestine. As soon as even before the war finished, as soon as it became apparent that Hitler and the Nazism was going to be destroyed, the Zionists split in two camps. The Stern Gang started sabotaging British centers and, again, British points of importance in Palestine. They bombed telephone poles, police stations. They again robbed banks. At one stage, they bombed 153 railway spots within a railway line within Palestine. They attacked detention camps. They released all the Jewish people who had come there and had been put in the detention by the British. And this carried on until they sank a British vessel. Great, great terrorist activities were carried on by the Ergan, Stern Gang, and the Haganah. The greatest of these terrorist activities was carried out on two British sergeants. Their names were Clifford Martin and Marvin Pace. They were both hung. That on its own was bad enough, but what they did is they booby-trapped their body so that whoever goes and gets them down would also be blown up. When they did this, the Times of London, and the title of the Times of London read, "The bestialities practiced by the Nazis themselves could go no further." And this is what the Times of London reported of the doings of the Zionists in Palestine. So basically, the Zionists were now employing Nazi tactics on the British and the Palestinians. The British basically got fed up. Although they wanted to create a Zionist state, according to the leadership itself, we read 1941 Churchill, by the end of the war, they could not take any more of the Zionist terrorist activities. They handed over the issue to the United Nations. We can look at this in two ways. Either they handed it over because they knew that the Zionists were now strong enough to establish, to stand up on their own two feet and defeat the Arabs, or because they were genuinely fed up with the terrorist activities of the Zionists and they could not control them. Either way, they gave the issue to the United Nations. As soon as they gave the issue to the United Nations was, even at that stage, under the direct influence of the United States of America. America proposed that the United Nations should go about and propose a petition. The UN resolution, the first UN action was to propose a petition of the Palestine. And this was not new. And we learned earlier from the time the Peel Commission, when the Britain had proposed this, what the Palestinians had reacted and how the Zionists had reacted. Similar thing happened in 1947. However, I'd like to give you a few statistics that of the 56 countries that voted, right, only by three votes did the vote go through. Only by three votes. They needed a majority of two-thirds. Of the 56 countries, 33 voted yes, 13 voted no, 10 abstained. That means three votes decided on the UN resolution to petition Palestine. And the way they petitioned Palestine was amazing. And this, I want to just think of a few things. Look at the justice here. In 1947, only 37% of the Palestinian population was Jewish. Only 37%. Yet the petitions gave 55% of the land to the Zionists. Okay. More important than this, only 7% of the land was owned by the Zionists. Only 7%. This is one of the greatest myths, that the Palestinians sold their land to the Zionists and gave it away. Look at the statistics. 1947, okay? Only seven, the highest, even if you look at the Zionist figures themselves, if you look at Benny Morris, he's a lecturer at Ben Gurion University today. He quotes a figure of 9%. I have not seen a figure over 11% by anybody. Okay, 7% is the most realistic figure. Even if you take the neo-Zionist figure of 9%, only 9% of Palestinian land in 1947 was owned by the Zionists. Yet, the United Nations wanted to give 55% of land to them. This was great injustice. The result was immediate. The Palestinians revolted, and they could not accept this. Of course, the Zionists were going to accept it. They were being given something for nothing. It wasn't theirs. Who would say no? The Palestinians revolted. Before they did that, they went to the International Court to say that this is unjust on several principles, on the two points I've mentioned. And the most important point was the Palestinian delegate was not at this UN meeting to decide their own fate. Somebody else was deciding for their behalf, and this was not acceptable to them. International court ignored them. You know, basically, you know, it's your problem. But this was a democracy again at work, as normal. The Arabs rejected that. The whole Arab entity rejected this plan. Immediately, the aggressions between the between the Palestinians and the Zionists began. And as I stated earlier, the Palestinian entity was not mobilized. They had no leadership. They had no army to speak of. They were still dependent on the for security upon the British or the neighboring countries. The neighboring countries had their own nationhood problems. They had a problem of either trying to create Islamic State, nationhood, secular state. They were again in the yoke of the colonialists, the British, especially Transjordan at that time. And to just show you one example, that the Haganah had already by then began their own factory in Tel Aviv of building ammunition. They were building their own grenades, they were building their own guns. The Palestinians were very, very weak. I would just like to give you a few examples of what happened. I would like to show you again how the Zionist entity, when they occupied, in 1947, they occupied only half of Jerusalem. Since we're talking about Masjid al-Aqsa as part of our talk, they only occupied half of Jerusalem, not the part that has Masjid al-Aqsa, but the western half. However, I would like you to remember and recall the differences of how Salahuddin liberated it, how Umar radiallahu anhu liberated it, and now let's see how the Zionist entity try to occupy Jerusalem and see whether we can compare them to Titus, compare them to Bukhtanazar, compare them to Heraclius, or can we compare them to the just and honorable leaders like Salahuddin and Hazrat Umar. The first thing they started to move towards Jerusalem, and the biggest massacre that took place was the Dar Yassin massacre. Dar Yassin is approximately 1 kilometer away from Jerusalem, and this was a road towards Jerusalem. Approximately 4:30 morning at Fajr time on Friday, they surrounded the village of Dar Yassin, the Zionist army, the Haganah, and I think it was all the Ergan and Sengan. Basically, the whole group was together. Dar Yassin village had accepted that they would not do anything to the Zionist entity. They had known the power of the Zionists at that time, and they had gone into an agreement with the local leader. The Mukhtar, the local head of Dar Yassin village, had told and gone into agreement with the Zionists that they will not attack or do anything against the Zionists. Under this agreement, the people of Dar Yassin felt safe. However, things changed. On 9th of April, as I said, at Fajr time, the city, the village was surrounded, and they moved into the village. They massacred each and every child, woman, and man in that village. I would just like to give you a report that was done by a Red Cross doctor, which he called the mopping up effect. He said, women's bellies were cut open and babies were butchered in the hands of their helpless mothers. Around 250 people were murdered in cold blood. They were maimed under the eyes of their own mothers, and they were slain and their heads were cut off. It is amazing. Women's bellies were cut open and babies were butchered. He said those people who were not thought to have died were gathered in houses, and then machine guns was rained on them and grenades thrown onto the house. Those that survived, the few that survived, they were tied and were marched up towards Jerusalem so that the people could see what they were, the bestiality of the Zionists. They were all killed and thrown into a well. This was one of the biggest massacres, most horrendous, carried out. And this mopping up, the British army was by the side of Daryasin village. They knew what was happening, but they did not intervene to help them. Immediately after Daryasin, the news spread far and wide. And there's a great myth, another myth, Zionist myth, that the Arab radios and the Arab world told the Palestinians to evacuate Palestinian homes and villages. A British journalist did a survey of radio broadcast, and they could not find any broadcast of such nature. The Zionists propagated this. After doing what they did at Daryasin, there were so many villages, honestly, brothers, if I go into each village will take us 10 minutes just to explain of what happened. You know, there was villages of Kazaz, Yahida, Qisas, Lehi, Sheikh, all these villages around Jerusalem. People were basically killed. And to quote you of what Menachem Begin, to boast about what they did in Daryasin, he wrote, this is what his writing is in his book called The Revolt. He wrote, without what was done at Daryasin, there could not have been a state of Israel. He confesses that the state of Israel has been created through murder and mayhem. Because that's what they did at Daryasin. This was a genocide of a people. Cold, calculated murder of people planned. It was not accidental. This is genocide of the Palestinian people. This was on 9th, 10th, and 11th of April, 1948. On 14th of May, Ben-Gurion, who was then the most wanted terrorist by the British, with his comrades, Menachem Begin and the likes, got together in Tel Aviv and declared the State of Israel. State of Israel was created not because of the United Nations plan, not because of America. It was created through the torture and through the barbaric acts of Zionism. And this was the genesis of the start of Israel. Immediately thereafter, the Arab Revolt of 1948, or the Arab War, begins. I will come to that, inshallah, next week, so that we look at that and how the Arabs failed in the 1948-49 war. But this, my brothers, is the beginning of the state of what they call the State of Israel. Jazakallah khair. Brothers, I would also like to request something. Hopefully, alhamdulillah, a lot of brothers have been coming here continuously and you've been listening to these lectures. We need to act and do things within the parameters of the laws of the countries. We don't have to do anything illegal. And the first thing we need to do is inform our own brothers and ourselves of what is happening. Alhamdulillah, Friends of Al-Aqsa has got a lot of literature which we give out free. It's not to buy. A lot of you brothers have contacts outside the city of Leicester. You know some masajids, you know some schools, some colleges, some university students who go to some universities. Collect the leaflets from us and give them to them so that they can spread the news. It's very, very important. We have leaflets on how to boycott Zionist schools. We've got leaflets about the history of Masjid Al-Aqsa. We've got, I think, about 12 titles. We could do more. We need your assistance, brothers. We need your assistance to spread this news as far and wide as possible. This is the first step. Once we become informed about the issue of Palestine, then only can we become to understand, and then hopefully through that look for solutions. If we're going to look for a solution without understanding the issue, I think it's very difficult. You know, we're trying to fly before we can walk. So this is the first step. I accept and realize, you know, we're on the ground level at the moment. And I urge you, with greater sincerity, those especially who have contacts outside Leicester, please come to us. Collect this stuff. Ask local masjid, wherever that locality is. Take all our stuff for free and ask them to distribute it in their institute.
I would like to now request Mawlana Yahya Salam, and please make the office. Mawlana, if you like, come in the front. Thank you.